IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello and welcome to All Things Policy. I am Saurabh Todi and I have with me my colleague Aditya Ramanathan. And today we are going to discuss the very significant news that was released yesterday. Yesterday as in on March 11th, that India has tested successfully the Agni 5 missile with MIRV capability. Now, what is Agni 5, what is MIRV, and all of these things, we'll go to Aditya to explain. But a very warm welcome, Aditya. And this seems to be a very significant milestone for Indian defense kind of preparedness.
Yeah. Thanks, Saurabh. Yeah, great to be here. It is definitely a milestone. I mean, when you think back to more than 25 years back when India first tested its nuclear weapons, and 1999, India committed itself formally to a credible minimum deterrent. We've seen a considerable evolution of India's nuclear forces since then, and really the definition of what is credible and what is minimum and what deters has changed. This is normal. These are not static but moving targets, and ultimately they depend on the evolution of technology as well as what your strategic situation looks like. So yeah, I don't think anybody who even casually follows this space was terribly surprised that India tested MIRVing capability, right? This has been in the works for a long time, and it was long expected. There are some, obviously, some external as well as internal drivers for this. It's definitely an interesting development, and it really is going to bring up some important choices for India to make about how it structures its nuclear forces, how its command and control works, and all of these things, right? So because when India first went overtly nuclear, its nuclear forces were kept at a very relaxed posture, and it still retains the no first use doctrine that it started with. And one of the ways in which it sort of that doctrine was reflected downstream in the nuclear forces was that warheads, from what we understand, were largely kept disassembled and could be put together at a moment of crisis or when you actually need to commit to retaliation. That may still be so for some parts of the nuclear forces, but if India's, for example, MIRVs, SLBMs on the Arihant and other future ballistic missile submarines or to go into operation, you are going to have some fully assembled, ready to go warheads on missiles, fully mated, and ready to fire once authorization is received. So in that sense, there is clear evolution of India's nuclear forces. Size hasn't really gone up, so we have, it's all kept secret in India, and basically you're going by a handful of estimates, but most estimates would place the number of Indian nuclear warheads at somewhere between 160 and 200. They're all fission warheads. So India doesn't really have truly proven thermonuclear capability, and it hasn't grown dramatically, India's nuclear forces, but we've definitely seen over the last quarter century an evolution.
Thanks, Aditya. For our listeners, so Agni 5 is the follow up of the Agni series of missiles that was developed as part of the integrated guided missile program started in 1980s. So, Aditya, why is this test significant? Like, first of all, like, what are MIRVs, and what was so significant in India testing Agni 5 with MIRVs? So, like, what's its range, or what is the big deal about Agni 5 as a missile, and then the MIRV part of it?
Sure. So, first thing is, all long-range ballistic missiles are space weapons in the sense that they exit the Earth's atmosphere and and then re-enter the Earth's atmosphere at another point, and then move and hit their targets or burst over their targets. What MIRV simply means is multiple independently targetable re-entry vehicles. You can also have MRVs, which are just multiple re-entry vehicles. Independently targetable simply means that once the missile exits the Earth's atmosphere, it's, you know, there's a so-called bus in. It's called a bus phase, you know. And this bus travels some distance. It maneuvers into a certain position. And then it ejects the MRVs or MIRVs into space. And then each of these can then further target themselves appropriately wherever they have to go. And then they re-enter the Earth's atmosphere. And re-entering the Earth's atmosphere is you know, sort of like a meteorite. You know, you basically enter the Earth's atmosphere in a big ball of fire. And, you know, if you see tests, footage from tests of MIRVs, that's what it looks like. And you see multiple MIRVs coming down and, potentially airbursting. You know, obviously when tests happen, they normally just fall into the sea, into the oceans. And that's what seems to have happened in this case. So that's basically what a MIRV is. MIRVs really started with the American Minuteman III ICBM and that first developed in 1968, but went into operation in 1970. And what you saw then in that decade of the 70s between the US and the Soviet Union was this MIRVing competition, right? So even though the two sides had agreed to what was called SALT I or Strategic Arms Limitation Talks in 72, as well as the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty. By the way, these are related. We can discuss why. What though that treaty did not adequately cover was MIRVing. And so both sides just MIRVed like there was no tomorrow. And then they tried to curtail this, but it didn't quite work out. And by 1980, there was, you know, the atmosphere for talks had disappeared. The detente, Cold War detente was over. So, and that's really the history of MIRVs and, you know, how MIRVs just became very common. And, you know, it was a household term. I mean, my parents in the 1980s tell me MIRV was just something that everybody knew in India as well, right? Things changed since then after the Cold War. You know, I think MIRVs moved out of the popular lexicon and sort of slowly come back in the last decade or decade and a half as reality sets in once again. So the MIRVs are a part of what states do to basically increase their options for targeting and as well as for defeating ballistic missile defenses. So just to go over what MIRVs can do. So one key rationale for MIRVs is that because you have this bus that ejects multiple warheads, it basically creates a lot more targets for a ballistic missile system to intercept. Now, ballistic missile systems, contrary to what I think sometimes people believe, are not these perfect shields. They are actually pretty bad at the job of intercepting ICBMs. Though obviously they've been getting better, which is just actually you know, one of the big drivers of MIRVing in our time right now. That's one of the big reasons that you MIRV. Now, there are other ways to also defeat ballistic missile defenses. So even if you have a single warhead, you can set off decoys as well as chaff. So even single warhead missiles, for example, what will happen is typically when they are in space and before they re-enter the Earth's atmosphere, they also often deploy decoy Mylar balloons, which are basically like military grade versions of party balloons, but they inflate in the shape of you know, those shiny Mylar party balloons, but they inflate in the shape of the warhead roughly. And because they're in space and there's no significant atmosphere, physically they behave and they move around in exactly the same way, right? The big warhead and the Mylar balloon, which has almost no mass. And so for an X-band radar tracking these from the ground, it's very hard to tell what is a balloon and what is a warhead. And on top of that, these missiles also just often just throw off chaff. Chaff is, you know, little bits of aluminum or other metal foil. This is, you know, it's one of those normal countermeasures that are used in aircrafts and so on to basically throw off radars. And you can get really creative about this, right? So if once you, for example, MIRV or use MRVs, you can deploy Mylar balloons as well as chaff. You can also set up your missiles to deploy chaff and MIRVs together so that some of the MIRVs are also, you know, basically enclosed in a bubble of chaff, right? So even once an enemy's radar really gets good at differentiating between chaff and MIRVs, it still doesn't know that there's not a MIRV hidden inside a chaff, right? I mean, so basically, this has been going on since the 70s as countries have gotten really more and more clever about how they do this and how they fool their adversaries. And so while MIRVing is not the only way to defeat ballistic missile defenses, it is nice to have multiple warheads to do that. Now, of course, this does involve a trade-off, which is, you know, for example, I talked about the Minuteman III. The Minuteman III's original warhead, the single warhead version, if I remember correctly, its yield was 1.2 megatons. It was a thermonuclear warhead. But when it MIRVed, basically you had three MIRVs inside the same missile, and each of those had a yield of about 170 kilotons, right? So you're giving up a lot of yield for the purpose of, you know, ensuring that your warheads get through the ballistic missile defenses. Now, the other thing that MIRVs can do is, and this is where they can get really controversial, is that once these are really good at targeting, they are not, you know, you don't necessarily just need to use MIRVs to blow up cities, which is what people imagine. The scary part about MIRVs is what is typically called counterforce. Now, what that means simply is that you attack the enemy's military forces. And really, when you're using nuclear weapons, you attack the enemy's nuclear forces. So the idea is that you are weakening or even potentially destroying your adversary's nuclear forces and thereby reducing or even eliminating, potentially in theory, their ability to retaliate against you. There are a lot of complications involved in this, but that's the theory. That's the basic rationale for MIRVs. So where does India fit into this? Well, quite simply, we've seen major changes in ballistic missile defense over the last 20 odd years. So I mentioned the 1972 anti-ballistic missile treaty between the Americans and the Soviets. You know, that came out of a recognition that anti-ballistic missiles were at that time, you know, the tech wasn't there, and neither of us really benefit from this. Let's just focus on offensive weapons, both building them and controlling them through agreements. But by 2002, things had changed. And really what changed was sensors, communications, processors, right? The IT and communications revolution. And then came 9/11 in 2001. And the Americans started worrying, apparently quite sincerely, about rogue missile launches. And in 2002, they exited from the anti-ballistic missile treaty. And they've since then focused a lot more on development of their ballistic missile defense systems. So the most important of these are the ground-based mid-course interceptors that America has in Alaska and California. These are some of the most capable, these are quite simply the most capable missile interceptors that exist on Earth. And even they don't have like 100% chance of success. So typically people put their odds at about 50% per interceptor for intercepting a single ICBM. Now, if you have to intercept three different MIRVs on a single missile, you'd have to deploy six of these interceptors to get a sporting chance of actually knocking out all three of them. So while ballistic missile defenses are, have definitely developed a lot, the odds are still stacked against them. Still, India sees this, this development, and it starts thinking about its own ballistic missile defense. Then US and Chinese competition heats up. And this is not just direct US and China competition over, say, Taiwan or the South China Sea. There's also this complicating factor of North Korea. Because North Korea has now got a range of ICBMs, I don't think they've still MIRVed that. I think they're still far from that right now. But they've got ICBMs with single warheads and presumably, some decoys and all of that, which can reach the continental United States. The Americans are continuing to seriously fund their ballistic missile defense systems. And they've also deployed, for example, at least one THAAD, which is a terminal ballistic missile defense system, terminal phased ballistic missile defense system in South Korea. So the Chinese look at this and say, well, we need to, make sure that we can get through those American missile defenses. I mean, sure, those might be good for North Korea, but we need to make sure that we can get through those. So we need to have our own MIRVing capability. So, starting in 2015, we saw the first credible reports of China MIRVing with a variant of the old DF5 missile, the DF5B, it was typically called, which apparently had up to 2 MIRVs. But really, since then, you know, it's proliferated. The new DF-41s, which are a solid fuel ICBM, which can be put on mobile launchers, and something like 330 silos that we've discovered in the western deserts of China. These are, you know, solid fuel rockets, so they're ready to go, and they might have anywhere between 3 and 8 MIRVs. We don't really know. So, you know, you're dealing with an uncertain threat there. And India sees all this. And on top of that, China is developing its own ballistic missile defense system because it's trying to compete strategically with the United States. Now, why China's not competing, it's directing its ballistic missile systems necessarily at India, because these systems are in development. India has to take this into account, and it has to develop its own MIRVing capability to defeat this Chinese ballistic missile defense system. And the reason is not because we want to nuke China, but obviously because you want to have a credible second strike capability. So you have, you know, you have some measure of strategic stability. What's interesting is that Pakistan sort of thinks the same way about India as India thinks about China, right? So for the Pakistanis, they're looking at these Indian developments. And in fact, Pakistan tested their own MIRV capable missile back in November. So they've actually sort of beaten us to it. I don't know what their test involved. It's the Ababil missile is essentially, again, I think has 3 MIRVs. And the idea, the rationale that the Pakistanis have cited is, look, India is also developing ballistic missile defense capabilities of its own. And so you know, we need to make sure that we can defeat those so that, again, there's stability between India and Pakistan. So you have US-China tensions over Taiwan and South China Sea, as well as North Korea driving ballistic missile defenses in China, which is driving ballistic missile defenses in India, which is driving ballistic missile defenses in Pakistan. I think identified this dynamic way back in 2015. I remember writing something about it back then. This has been obvious for a while, so it's not terribly surprising. But yeah, that's where we are at. Long answer, sorry.
Stay tuned to All Things Policy. We'll be right back after a short commercial break.
It's quite fascinating, right? Because this chain reaction, and this is what, you know, happens consistently, that, you know, in this China US or a US Russia kind of competition, all the other powers that are in the region also have the same anxieties and have the same concerns, respond in a way, and then this chain reaction just keeps on going. But I am curious that where does the having a MIRV capability sit in India's nuclear doctrine? So we say that we are committed to no first use and to credible minimum deterrence. So how does a MIRV capability help in those two components?
Yeah, thanks. So that's I think one of the questions that's vexing all of us. India. One of the problems, like I mentioned with MIRVs, is that you can also use them for counter-force targeting, for attacking an adversary's nuclear forces. And certainly that seems to be the stated concern, at least from Pakistan, that Indian MIRVing could potentially be used to hit Pakistan's own nuclear forces and disarm or weaken them. I think that's a fairly remote possibility for a bunch of reasons, including simply the fact that if you airburst a bunch of nukes over Pakistan, the westerly winds are going to basically push all those radioactive clouds over India. So disarming major nuclear strikes by India over Pakistan is not that great an idea. But yeah, having said that, you can understand why states have these kind of anxieties, or at least have an interest in saying that they have these kind of anxieties. What does it mean then? So for India's nuclear posture, I think what India has to do is to be very clear in its strategic communication, but also be in deciding the structure of its nuclear forces. So, and, you know, an adversary can actually eventually tell if a state is actively pursuing major counterforce capabilities, or is simply pursuing a bunch of capabilities that, yes, some of which can be used for counterforce, but is mostly used for assured retaliation. What we mean by assured retaliation is that the nuclear force's ability to absorb a first strike and then still have enough nuclear forces left to retaliate in a way that you inflict unacceptable damage on the adversary, right? So no first use is sometimes seen as this is sometimes seen as this nice guy version of nuclear doctrine. It's not. Actually, it's pretty nasty. No first use is basically saying, if you hit me, not just will I survive, I'll inflict terrible damage on you. So, you know, no first use has no compunctions about committing genocide, about doing mass murder, about killing lots of civilians. On the hand, a lot of first use postures, you know, like those of America and so on, are all about, let's just target the enemy's military and their industrial infrastructure and stuff like that. Of course, in doing that, you'll kill millions of civilians. But, you know, the point is simply that, no first use is actually a pretty nasty and effective way of organizing, idea on which to organize your nuclear forces. And India and China definitely have pledged no first use. Now, as far as what it means for this posture, it really depends on how much India MIRVs, whether MIRVs just become standard on all Indian ICBMs, as well as, you know, ultimately on public communication. So, you know, India's SLBM program, the Submarine Launch Ballistic Missile Program, is still a work in progress. And India is going to eventually come up with a new class of nuclear submarines, which are larger than the current Arihant class. And, you know, so you are... The goal of India seems to be to have this large continuous at-sea deterrent, which is, you know, to have at least 6 ballistic missile submarines. So at least 4 of them are at any point at sea. And so they're always ready to commit a retaliation. And the idea of ballistic missile submarines is that they're harder to detect. You don't exactly know their locations. So once they launch, it's harder to defend against them and so on. And so the idea is... Now, if those ballistic missiles, submarine launch ballistic missiles, have also start MIRVing, it can start creating questions in other countries about what exactly India is trying to do. Unfortunately, India is locked in a tripartite nuclear relationship, a triad really, with China and Pakistan. And India sometimes just feels it has to ensure that its nuclear forces are survivable against China. You know, in a crisis, it's really useful if leaders on both sides believe that, you know, I want in a India-China crisis, I want the leaders of both India and China to believe that Indian nuclear forces can absorb a first strike and fight back, right? Because that actually makes the crisis less risky, right? It actually makes it more stable. The challenge is, of course, Pakistan is going to see all this differently. If you have a bunch of ballistic missile submarines that can accurately launch MIRVs, and, you know, look, here's a really terrible thing that's happened in the last 25 years. We've seen this precision-guided munition revolution really since the Gulf War. That precision-guided munitions revolution also applies to nuclear weapons. And it means that nuclear weapons are just... have become inherently more and more accurate and have the potential to become more accurate. And what that means is that they can be used for so-called counterforce. It's not how India thinks, but I can excuse a Pakistani for worrying about that. If India were to develop, you know, a massive continuous at-sea deterrent with SLBMs that can deploy MIRVs, you know, it's scary. So I think that's something India has to learn how to manage in order to not repeat what I think were the mistakes of the 1970s, where you had a fairly unnecessary race to MIRV, which only slowed down in the years afterwards. So, yeah, I do hope that India, China and Pakistan can avoid that.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. And I think, as you said, like this kind of like a triad between India, China and Pakistan, where, I mean, India... invariably has to respond to what China is developing, but China has US in mind, which obviously is decades ahead. And then obviously Pakistan gets very anxious, and then they develop. And I think, as you said, that there have also been some reports that Pakistan may be, in its doctrine, open to using tactical nukes, which India and China don't seem to be wanting to use. So because Pakistan is trying to kind of handle its own insecurity in one way. I mean, I would say that there will always be issues regarding funding and regarding capabilities of how much Pakistan can develop. There's only so much it can compete with, let's say, India, but it may open up fronts in some other ways. In like, for example, tactical nukes, where it might make the whole thing unstable. So on that not very hopeful note, thanks a lot, Aditya. Hopefully we will discuss this again when the countries realize that maybe we don't have to go this far and we can have a ABM like treaty for in Asia. But until then, one can be hopeful.
Saurabh, I really wish I shared your enthusiasm about this. But really, since 2019, we've all been saying arms control is dead. And what's happened since we kept saying arms control is dead is that every new arms control treaty seems to die. I do think that eventually countries will come to their senses. It's great to hear that the US and China have begun a strategic dialogue. This is really, really important. And I hope one day India and China can enter a strategic dialogue. It's really the Chinese side. I don't mean to do a blame game here, but it's really the Chinese side that's been holding this up. One last point I'll just make is that besides the risk of tactical nukes that you mentioned, there's also the risk that Pakistan might feel the need to send its deterrent to sea. So that could be both on conventionally powered submarines as well as some surface vessels. It's a terrible idea, but also it's not inconceivable that Pakistan might want its own nuclear powered ballistic missile submarines. Certainly some Pakistanis have talked about it, but given Pakistan's financial state, I'm not sure how they'll go about that. Let's hope springs eternal, and certainly we'll have lot more to discuss about this on All Things Policy.
Yeah, thanks Aditya. Thank you.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle @TakshashilaInst or our website takshashila.org.in.
Hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them. Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM Podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week: Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank, and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.